Samuel Beckett, A Personal Memoir, written and narrated by John Calder. Remembering Samuel Beckett more than 15 years after his death, and separating the man from his work is not easy, because the man to a great extent is his work, and the more one immerses oneself in the world of his novels and plays, not to speak of his poetry, the more one realizes that the landscapes he describes, the characters he created, and the thinking from which the work emerges are all reflections of his personality. He was a straightforward man, and in essence a simple one, with an extraordinary mind that had received an exceptionally wide-ranging education, which was only the start of what was to go into that mind, both in revelation about the intricacies of the human situation and realizations about the tragedy that must befall us all. As a writer, he had the depth, brilliance, and the poetic intensity of William Shakespeare, the other literary figure with whom he is most often associated. We can identify ourselves and our private thoughts with his characters, even though they are, on the surface, very different from the ways we see ourselves, and for the most part, very uncongenial. This personal memoir has to start with our first meeting. When Waiting for Godot was first performed in 1955 in London at the Arts Theatre, in Peter Hall's production, I went to see it, largely because that small theatre club was where one expected quality productions of unusual and interesting new plays. I liked the evening, was undoubtedly rather puzzled by the work itself, and might have forgotten about it, had not a friend from Cheshire come to London. When I asked him what he wanted to see, he replied, Godot. On this second visit, the full force of the poetic lines and the human tragedy they conveyed so originally hit me firmly between the eyes. And being then a young independent publisher looking for authors, I decided to contact Samuel Beckett directly. I obtained the address of his French publisher, but it was the wrong address, and the letter took 2 weeks to arrive. It finally did, on the same day, but one post later, that a similar letter from Faber and Faber. Edition de Minuit, the French publisher, then offered the play to Faber, as theirs was the first letter that they opened. In the meantime, my efforts to reach the author directly had succeeded, and I contacted him with another letter, which brought an instant reply, inviting me to call on him in Paris. I telephoned, offered to come in a few days, and Sam gave me a dinner appointment at a restaurant in Montparnasse. I did not then know the fate of my letter to Minuit, but was told at dinner. But Sam Beckett and I got on very well, found we had much in common to discuss, and towards the end of the meal he said to me, I am sorry you are not going to publish me in a way, but in another way I am quite pleased. One always quarrels with one's publisher. I'd rather have you as a friend. I had no choice but to accept the decision, but already had developed an immense liking for this erudite, friendly Irishman, able to switch from talking about current politics to the music we both liked, but books and authors we knew about to some general topics. Having finished dinner, he suggested a drink somewhere else. We found a small bistro for a brandy, and then another one for a beer, where we began to play chess. But the evening did not end there. Somewhere else I found myself playing ping-pong with Sam while more beers were slowly down, and dawn was well up when we had breakfast together somewhere on the Boulevard Montparnasse. Shortly afterwards I found myself in New York, and in the office of a new American publisher, Barney Rossett, who had acquired the American rights to Waiting for Godot. Sylvia Beach had told him about Beckett, and he had followed her advice in taking up this one-time friend of her idol, James Joyce. Rossett was also very enthusiastic about Beckett's pre-war novel Murphy, published in Britain in 1938, that had at the time had only one good review in an Oxford magazine from Iris Murdoch, then a student. She was to mention it in her first post-war novel, Under the Net. Practically the entire first edition of Murphy had been destroyed in the London Blitz. In 1957, Bonnie Rossett republished it, and I was selling the American edition in Britain, until he eventually enabled me to bring out my own British one in a new series that I inaugurated in the 60s. I was fairly frequently in Paris in those days, and an evening with Sam became a routine part of every visit. We nearly always had dinner alone together, and went on to cafes, continuing to talk, but also playing chess, ping-pong, and sometimes billiards. Sam was a better player than myself at nearly everything, but occasionally, when he had more to drink than I had, I might win a game. It was the conversation that mattered. It usually went on until we separated in the early morning. One evening, in 1961, when we met, the newspapers were full of Hemingway's suicide, and we never got off the topic. We agreed that suicide was the best way to die, but Sam's problem was how not to leave a mess for others to clean up, while mine was how to do it quickly and painlessly. What else did we discuss? All the problems of life, our thoughts about deeper meaning, philosophy, and literature in general, and there was always much about music. We both particularly admired classics, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert in particular. Sam had some reservations about Mozart, and much preferred Haydn, some of whose piano music was in his finger memory. I think his problem with Mozart was the man's facility, the apparently light-hearted ability to write sublime music without any effort at all. It was easier for him than breathing. We also discussed contemporary composers, and there I knew as much, sometimes more, than he did. He associated art with pain, and especially the great effort involved in breaking new ground. I knew that for Sam, writing was torture, that every sentence went under intense scrutiny, that he identified the effort of extreme concentration with mental pain. The same could be said of Beethoven, whom he greatly admired. His love of Schubert lay not just in the somber underlying feeling and poignant atmosphere of the late works in particular, but also in the tragedy of such genius, cut off at 33. It became obvious to me that he not only admired the early romantics, but emotionally he belonged to that feeling himself. In the same way, he had a reverence for many German writers of the same period, such as Goethe, Claudius, and Fontana. Although there were so many dinners and all-night drinking and talking sessions, the drinking was slow, usually only beer after he had left the restaurant. I never made any effort to remember, and certainly not to record our conversations in any way. I remember many anecdotes he told me about James Joyce and a few others from pre-war Paris, the general tenor of what philosophers had written and writers and poets had revealed to him through his reading, but above all the wash of a well-stocked mind that could, on occasion, quote long passages from Dante or other much-studied authors. When we first met, Samuel Beckett was 49 and I was 28. The 21-year seniority in age made little difference in what turned out to be a long friendship. Gradually our two circles came a little together, and we found ourselves more in the company of other people. But before that, I had already become his publisher, not of the plays, because Favour, having done extremely well out of Waiting for Godot, naturally took on the British rights of the plays that followed it, while Rossett had American rights. But they were not interested in the other work. This is what happened. I received a telephone call from Sam one day in 1957, or it might have been the previous year. It was to tell me that Faber, having been sent the French original volumes of Malone Dies and The Unnameable, had turned them down as possibly obscene under the law as it then existed. They had been obliged to expurgate Waiting for Godot, at the time subject to censorship by the Lord Chamberlain. Although the arts were the theatre club, and the cuts demanded were lighter than when the play later transferred to the Criterion Theatre on Piccadilly Circus, Beckett felt that his work had been considerably emasculated, and that the biblical cuts made it almost unworkable. He was, of course, unhappy that the printed version of the play included most of the Lord Chamberlain's cuts, and now Faber had decided that the two French novels they had read were possibly prosecutable. Malone Dies and The Unnameable have always been considered as the second two parts of a trilogy that starts with Molloy, but the three novels have been published independently as different books in France, while the English-language rights to the first one had already been sold to Olympia Press, best known for publishing English-language erotica in Paris. That may have played a part in Faber's negative thinking at the time. In his telephone call, Sam went on to tell me that if I were still interested, I should ring Jérôme Lendon of Édition de Minuit and ask for the rights. I immediately did so, acquired both novels, and Malone Dies in Beckett's own translation then appeared under my imprint in 1958, The imprint was John Calder Publishers Limited. On the same day, I published an Iranian novel by Sadi Hedayat, The Blind Owl, a weird and ghostly masterpiece by a poet who had committed suicide in Paris and had long been banned in his native country, and still is today. The two books were reviewed together, and not well. The crime reviewer of the Sunday Times had put them both in his column, and had ended by saying, "Mescaline might help, but don't count on it." Cyril Connolly, some time later in the same newspaper, used his column to advise his readers whether or not they should bother to read this man Beckett, who was now in his 50s and was attracting some attention, and wrote that although there appeared to be some talent there, the answer was no. Beckett was not worth the bother. In the publishing trade, Samuel Beckett began to be talked about as Calder's folly. One reason that I was so often in Paris in the late 50s was that my first marriage had come to an end, and I was courting an opera singer who was working there. My mother had a Paris flat at the time, so it was easy to stay. Beckett met the lady I was seeing on occasion, who I married in 1961. He would come to her concerts and have dinner with us afterwards. Bonnie Rossett, his American publisher, was also frequently in Paris, and his ex-wife, the painter Joan Mitchell, was now living with another painter, the Canadian Jean-Paul Riopelle. They were both friendly with Beckett as well. There were meetings and dinners with sometimes up to 20 people at long tables at the Coupole, then the most popular restaurant in Montparnasse for the artistic community, where I remember often sitting up until dawn in the company, not just of Beckett, but with friends such as Alberto Giacometti, the sculptor, who had on one occasion designed a tree for a French goddess at the Odeon Theatre, that was, unfortunately, thrown away at the end of the production, and many other Coupole regulars. These included Saul Steinberg, the American cartoonist, Avigdor Elika and his wife, the poet Anne Erique, and Henri Iden, the painter, and his wife Josette, one or two Irish friends, like Con Leventhal, who had taken Sam's place at Trinity when he left, and the journalist Peter Lennon. Henri and Josette Iden had shared Sam Beckett's wartime experiences, hiding with him and Suzanne, his resistance partner, who only married him in the 60s. And later they were living not very far from his little house in the Marne mud, as he liked to put it, near Issy-sur-Marne, where he did most of his writing during the 60s and later. Sam did not like eating at the Coupole much, but he often used the American bar area to meet friends early in the evening. If it was me, we would then go on to a favourite fish restaurant, frequently the Ile Marquise, and when that became less congenial, or too full, to La Palette, which I realised, as it seldom had many customers, could not last for long. There were many bars we frequented in Montparnasse, the favourite being often the Falstaff, just a few doors away from the Coupole. Although this had a restaurant, we used it principally to talk late at night. Another such was the Rosebud, named after the sledge in the famous Orson Welles film about the life of William Randolph Hearst, Citizen Kane. Sam in those days went seldom to the cinema, and, like myself, much preferred the old pre-war films, many of which had been the inspiration for some of his work. One memorable evening at the Falstaff occurred during the week that the Rossett-financed film, commissioned from Sam, was shown in Paris at a private projection room. It was a short film, simply called that, film, was an illustration of Bishop Berkeley's famous dictum, one had to be observed to be sure one existed. Sam rang me up to say that it was to be shown every night for a week, that during the first part of the week it was the commercial distributors who had been invited, and that the last performances were for friends. I decided to come on the very last night, a Saturday. In the early evening, we saw the film which Alan Schneider had directed, and in which Buster Keaton, a survivor from the old silent cinema era, played a part that he could neither comprehend nor see any purpose in. Schneider had never directed a film before, but he had become Beckett's favourite American director for his plays in the U.S. I found the film interesting, like all Sam's concepts, but the actual execution verging on the amateur. Afterwards, about 30 of us went back to the Falstaff. I had asked permission to bring Philip Stebb, an enthusiast who had helped to finance the English-language Endgame, I shall mention later. Philippe wanted to pay his own way, but the proprietor of the fourth staff told us that Beckett had paid for a large crowd every night for a week, and he would lose a valuable customer if he allowed anyone to pay even a franc. It was a strange evening, and I knew more than half of those present. Food and drink were there in plenty, and English and French were about evenly spoken. Patrick McGee, the original crap, having had the part written for him by Sam after he had heard his voice on the BBC, reading the novel Molloy, was in many ways Beckett's favourite English-language actor. But he could be very pugnacious with a drink or two inside him, and it did not take long before he was having a quarrel with someone at the bar. Beckett had invited his own guests, but there were many other customers to the fourth staff as well, and very soon fists were flying. It was Beckett himself who broke it up, restraining Pat and bringing him back to the table to calm him down. During the 6 nights of the screening, followed by a party every night, Sam must have consumed a great deal of wine and alcohol, not to speak of the expense, which must have greatly exceeded whatever figure he had been paid to write the scenario in the first place. He was soon showing signs of having drunk too much, though it was not often, in spite of our all-night bouts, that I had seen him the worse for wear. But he was being nagged by a lady with whom he had a long-term relationship to stop drinking and go home with her. He ignored the pleas for a long time, and then turned on her in exasperation, telling her that she wanted to go home to do so. Tight-lipped, she left, and the party went on. Not long after that I left myself, hoping to get the last flight back to London, but the plane had left when I arrived at Oily, and I spent the night uncomfortably sprawled across 2 airport chairs until the morning. Airports occur many times in my memories. Once I met Sam at Heathrow coming in from Paris, and I noticed immediately that he was in a strange mood. When I questioned him, he looked pensive. It was a strange and worrying feeling, he told me. Once they had closed the doors, the captain's voice came over the loudspeaker. Votre commandant Gardeau vous souhaite la bienvenue à bord. I wondered if my destiny had caught up with me at last. I told that anecdote at a conference at Reading University a little time later. It has been much repeated, but everyone has forgotten the source. I did fly to Paris with him on one or two occasions, and I remember one in particular. Sam was once again in a rather strange mood, and as we drove up to the airport, he suddenly said, "Why don't we go first class and drink free brandy on the way?" Being the kind of publisher I was, always careful of expenditure, it did not suit me at all to go first class, but anything Sam wanted, I would go along with, so I agreed. But once we were at the ticket desk, it turned out that the first class was full, so we went economy and paid for our brandies. As we approached Oily, Sam suddenly said, "Suzanne is going to meet us. I think we might have dinner at the Oily Airport restaurant. The food's quite good." Suzanne was there as we emerged from customs, and we went to the restaurant. We had hardly ordered before she was raising domestic issues. Madame Ionesco had telephoned her to ask her advice about something. She had not known what to say, because Sam kept all his professional problems to himself. "Madame Ionesco is an emmerdeuse," he responded, shrugging the issue off. "But she helps her husband," Suzanne went on. "Why would you never let me help you?" I wished passionately not to be there, but anywhere else. It was not so much a domestic row as what was obviously an everyday scene, a persistent nagging countered by ever sharper retorts and a refusal to let her get involved in its correspondence and dealings, professional or otherwise, with others. Why did I have to be there listening to all this? I knew Suzanne could only hold it against me in future. Sam, of course, as I knew well, did do everything himself. He had no secretary or amanuensis. When Con Leventhal retired from Trinity, he moved to Paris. It was understood that Sam would pay him something to act as an assistant, but this never came to any more than forwarding letters to Issy, Sam's country home, when Sam went there to work, or accompanying him during his lunch engagement with academics or theatre producers. As Suzanne continued her recriminations, and I tried to be as invisible as possible, Sam's mood was getting worse, and I realized that he had anticipated this on the plane. I also remembered that just as the aircraft was descending, he had said to me, "You know, Suzanne is the only French woman I have ever known who will not touch a drop of wine or any alcohol." He was indeed drinking water, while Sam and I got fairly quickly through a bottle of Sancerre. Sam then ordered another bottle. Suzanne put a hand on his arm. "Please don't drink so much," she said. "It's bad for you." "John likes wine," was his response. And the other bottle came. It was eventually followed by a third. When I went on to Paris on my own, it was with deep regret that having witnessed the scene, I would have given much to have missed. There were, of course, other pleasanter occasions, but always with something a little wrong. Once I was invited to dinner with the Becketts by Jerome Lendon and his wife, who lived not very far from Sam and Suzanne's apartment on the Boulevard Saint-Jacques. It was a nice evening, which I can't even remember the conversation, which was, of course, in French. We all left together and were walking towards Sam Street, still talking French. "Why don't we talk English?" suggested Sam, which had the effect of excluding Suzanne from the conversation. And I then noticed that she was no longer walking with us, but had dropped a pace or two behind. "What about stopping for a beer?" proposed Sam, and we sat down at a small outdoor cafe. Suzanne was obviously uncomfortable, and as soon as the beer arrived, she had ordered nothing. She said she was tired and left us. On that, an earlier occasion, I'd also felt that I was an intruder on the relationship. On the very few occasions I stayed in Sam's apartment, it was either because I had missed the last plane or the hotels were full. I slept on a couch with a window that overlooked the Santé prison. He was always fascinated by prisons, and it is no accident that his plays are often performed by prisoners in them. They knew well about the states of mind of his characters, brought down to the barest essentials of living, enclosed without hope, deprived of everything that can make life endurable, trapped in a misery they had mainly brought down on themselves. Sam knew the exact geography of the Santé, where the guillotine stood, when the executions took place. Capital punishment was only abolished in France in 1981, considerably later than in Britain. His fascination with suffering and empathy, with all that knew pain, extended to animal life as well. His early short story, Dante and the Lobster, attests to his shock at the discovery that lobsters are still alive when boiled. He did not like to sit near a fish tank in a fish restaurant, although fish was his favorite food. I did not know, until Sam told me, that trout often thrown alive into a frying pan. Once, when I was staying with him at Issy, we went for a walk on a fine morning. And when I asked him why he preferred to go one way rather than another, his reply was that the slaughterhouse lay on the other side. Like every well-known writer in France, he was constantly asked to put his name on manifestos and declarations for political, human rights, and other causes. Feeling that with his Irish passport he was really only a guest in France, he usually politely declined. But he did sign a manifesto for more humane slaughtering of animals for food. Sam could be unexpected in his attitudes at times. His courage at facing unpleasant reality applied more to himself than others. I attended a dinner party given for Roger Vaillant, author of La Loi, at which various friends tried to reassure Vaillant, who had only a few days to live after a cancer operation, that he was on the way to recovery. At dinner with Sam the next day, I related the incident, remarking that I thought it a shame to hide a reality that was only too obvious. A man of such intelligence deserved honesty at least. Sam looked at me with his laser eyes. "Another fucking moralist," was his terse comment. His eyes were indeed lasers at times. On one occasion, in order not to waste time on a long and pointless explanation, I told him a harmless white lie. Then he looked at me. "All right, Sam," I said, "I'll have to tell you the whole story." And I did. Sam knew a great many people, but he seldom discussed his friends or acquaintances with each other. It was at Les Îles Marquises that I met, because they were at the next table, Louis Aragon, the great surrealist poet and novelist, and others of the same group, some of whose work I was later to publish, and it was obvious that they all knew Sam well, and had done for many years. I did know, of course, that before the war, Sam had translated much surrealist literature into English for little magazines, Transition, for example, and Edward Titus's This Quarter. I had even asked Con Leventhal on one occasion to put together for publication a collection of those translations, and Con duly did so. But Sam stopped it. It was hack work, he said, done in a hurry to earn a little money, and not up to a good enough standard for republication. Con took back the manuscript, and I reluctantly abandoned the project. It was a pity, because having looked through it, I found the standard very high indeed. But there were problems with republishing even his pre-war other work. A new edition of Murphy he accepted, but when the work of fiction that preceded it, More Pricks and Kicks, came up for discussion, Sam was not happy. Rosset, through his New York firm Grove Press, was anxious to bring out an American edition, and by the end of the 50s we were working on it together, collaborating on typesetting, but each publishing a separate edition for his own market, mine being the British Commonwealth, with a free market in Europe and South America. Rosset was accustomed to getting his own way, and he kept up a constant pressure on Sam, whereas I tended to accept his decisions without argument. But eventually he did agree to our publishing in a Sackler-style typescript form 100 copies of More Pricks and Kicks, or Commerce, for the benefit of scholars. That is to say, academics who are now studying his work, and there was little more they could say or discover about Joyce. The 100 copies went fast enough, and a few months later he reluctantly agreed to another 100 being produced and sold. Rosset was often in Paris, and we spent many nights out together. But Rosset's interests were different from ours, more inclined to nightclubs and discussions on literature, philosophy, and classical music, of which he knew nothing. "Isn't that rather old-fashioned," he would say, when we talked about opera, as if anything new in fashion was all that could be interesting. Sam felt grateful to him for taking him on for American publication, when no one else was interested. And all his life he remained loyal to Barney. Even after he sold his firm in 1986 to Weidenfeld and the Getty oil interests. Whereas Sam was often impatient with me, especially if traffic made me late for an appointment, he was always indulgent with Barney. "Barney's always late," he said one day when he had waited more than half an hour, whereas he had been very angry with me, 10 minutes late the week before, having been caught in heavy traffic. When I asked for permission to do a 300 copies, au commerce, of the short stories, and this was when Barney Rosset was also putting on the pressure, Sam finally caved in and agreed to a commercially viable edition. There were problems with Routledge, who had published the original edition in 1934, who now claimed that if there was a reprint, that they still had the rights. But when it was clear that the author would only give permission to his post-war publishers, or not at all, they, too, acceded to Sam's wishes. The edition went into production, but Barney made a great mistake. He sent proofs to Sam to be corrected. This was either in late 1968 or early 1969. I arrived at Paris on a fine summer morning and went straight to the Closerie de Lila, not far from Sam's apartment, where we were to meet for lunch. A film crew was making a film outside the restaurant. When I went into the bar, I saw Peter O'Toole, who was obviously in the film, talking to Sam. Having spotted him sitting there, he was taking advantage of the occasion to try to talk him into letting him, O'Toole, make a film of Waiting for Godot. Many others had wanted to do the same, but so far permission had always been refused, Sam feeling that a stage play only belonged on the stage. I joined them, and after a few minutes Peter O'Toole had returned to filming. Sam turned to me with a heavy face. "I am sorry, John," he said. "I just can't let this old shit come out again. I've already written to Barney to tell him. I'm sorry, but the book's just too bad." And he handed over the proof which he had started to correct. Hiding my disappointment, I tried to enjoy our lunch and moved on to other topics. The limited au commerce editions had appeared in 1966-1967. Within 1969, Samuel Beckett was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was on holiday in Morocco at the time, and whatever his feelings about the honour of winning the world's most prestigious literary award, it is certain that he did not welcome the international publicity that it brought him. Because of the press attention, publishers everywhere clamoured to publish what was out of print or had never been translated. And certainly some of the pressure came from Editions de Minuit, now inundated with demands for contracts. Sam simply gave way, not for those very early works that he found most embarrassing, but for much else, and permission was finally given to proceed with War Pricks and Kicks. It appeared in 1970, and has since proved to be one of his most popular fiction works to readers. Other suppressed works followed, most notably First Love, written in French, and then reluctantly translated by the author. Mercier and Camier, written just after it, and also translated. Eleutheria, a play written not long before Godot, which has much in common with First Love, and that gives Beckett's self-portrait of himself, based largely on how his family saw him before his success with Godot, had to wait until several very bad posthumous translations were published by Rosset, to be eventually replaced by a literary one by Barbara Wright. But as the Beckett centenary year gets underway, no theatrical production has yet been authorised. By the time of the Nobel Prize, Beckett had advanced from his siege years of the late 40s, years that had brought him fame and success, and removed the worry that the growing lump in his cheek was cancerous and would bring an early death. From the time I first knew him, he was producing new prose, new plays, new poetry, often showing it to me straight off the typewriter. But I had to negotiate with others to obtain rights that I could not get directly from Sam or from Editions de Minuit. This brings Maurice Gerudias into the story. He was a man I liked who liked me, but I've never known anyone quite so complicated and in many ways perverse in his dealings with others. He has been badly treated in the memoirs of many, but unfairly or for the wrong reasons. At the same time, he brought nearly all his troubles on himself. His father, Jack Cahan, had been an Englishman who moved to France in the 20s and set up a publishing house in Paris to publish literature outside the narrow limits of what was permissible in English. He had published Henry Miller, Lawrence Durrell, his own novels, and a wide range of erotic literature, much of it of high merit, and had even commissioned a translation from Beckett of Sade's 100 Days of Sodom. This had been lost during the war. Gerudias started Olympia Press to follow in his father's footsteps, commissioned both erotica and serious literature and poetry for the large group of literary hopefuls who had moved to Paris in the late 40s and early 50s from English-speaking countries. Many of them were in a group that published Merlin, a literary journal that Olympia subsidized, and he agreed to bring out as Collection Merlin a number of titles that included Beckett's novels Watt and Molloy. The first was acquired after Richard Seaver, who later became Rosset's senior editor, had taken an interest in Beckett's French novels and had asked to see the manuscript of the unpublished English one. When Beckett delivered it in person during a Merlin editorial meeting and they read it aloud to each other, they found it enormously entertaining. The second was subsequently contracted by Editions de Minuit to be translated by one of themselves, but which Beckett himself found it necessary to revise. The reason I started with Malone Dies, and not its predecessor Molloy in 1958, was that the latter was already in print, in English, in Paris. Although I became very friendly with Maurice Gerudias, he was not willing to subcontract rights to Molloy until I came up with the idea, to satisfy all parties, of doing three separate editions of the trilogy that Beckett had always wanted. Rosset and I had the English language rights to Malone Dies and The Unnameable. We would allow Olympia Press to publish the trilogy in their Traveller Companion series, and we would do separate editions in our own markets, leaving Europe to Gerudias. This happened in 1959. It is possibly the most important idea I ever had, where publishing is concerned at least. The trilogy is considered by many to be the greatest fictional achievement of the 20th century, even taking Proust, Joyce and Kafka into account. Beckett knew Gerudias and the Merlin group well, was grateful to them for making some of his work available in English, when it was available nowhere else. But he soon lost patience with the slipshod editorial standards of young men whose eyes were mainly on their own careers, and with Rodias, who was always in trouble with creditors and the French police, with the British Home Office urged to close him down. Nevertheless, Rodias was a centre for English-speaking residents of literary Paris. Whenever he had some financial success, he indulged in some folly, the biggest of which was a building he acquired in the Rue Saint-Séverin, where at different times he had three quite separate restaurants, a nightclub, a theatre, and his publishing offices. On one occasion, during the middle 60s, an unusual encounter took place there. It was immediately after the annual Frankfurt Book Fair, and Girodias, having like Barney and myself just come to Paris from Germany, must have been somewhere in one of his swings from poverty to affluence, or vice versa. When money was coming in, he was very generous with advances to authors, and with general hospitality. But whether things were going well or badly, he was always optimistic that wealth lay just around the corner, and behaved accordingly. He was, at bottom, a romantic, who became involved in causes, took up enthusiasms, and lived the dream that luck or opportunity occasionally brought his way. But he had so often lost out to unscrupulous rivals, whether in publishing, catering, or general business, that he became overly suspicious and would cheat on a contract before the other party could do the same to him, which is what he always expected. On this occasion, he gave a big dinner in a large underground space that had been, or was about to be, a theatre or another restaurant, because he was always changing or redecorating according to some new enthusiasm. There may have been about 20 of us seated along the two sides of a long refectory table, with Rodias at the top, with two Métis, or mixed-race, sisters on each side of him. Barney was next to them, and diverse Olympia Press authors filled the middle of the table. Facing each other at the end were Samuel Beck and William Burroughs, who had never met before. I was next to Burroughs, and I remember no one at the very end. Rich or poor, Rodias always had fine wines, and the meal was good. Suddenly Beck had leaned across towards Burroughs, who was also my author, one who I had succeeded in publishing in Britain, in spite of many hostile reviews and a very controversial 14-week correspondence in the Times Literary Supplement, but without any legal prosecution, which I had known was on the cards. "Tell me, Mr. Burroughs," Sam said politely, "about this cut-up method of yours. I don't think I quite understand what you do." "Well, Mr. Beckett," drawled Burroughs in a voice that sometimes sounded southern, and at other times Harvard, "what I do is this. I take a copy of the New York Times or some other paper, and I cut a column in half down the middle, or sometimes I fold it. Then I find another text, perhaps one of mine, or perhaps a page of your Beloit, and I do the same thing." Beckett was listening in rapt attention. He opened his mouth to speak, and then closed it again. "Then," continued Bill Burroughs, "I reach across the lines of the two and copy out what I see, so that each line has one half of one text and half the other. Later, I edit the new version until a whole new text emerges. Then, depending on how it looks, I may cut that up into a third text. And, of course, I add a word or two where it is necessary." Beckett could contain himself no longer. "But you can't do that," he said. "Oh, I do, Mr. Beckett, I assure you," said Burroughs in an even voice. Both had been drinking heavily. No one else was listening. Rossett was interested in the two girls, who were obviously both girlfriends of Girodias, was very much a ladies' man, always in love, and with a string of simultaneous mistresses. Anything a little kinky fascinated Barney Rossett. The writers were talking among themselves about their own affairs. The argument went on between my two authors, the classically trained Dublin gentleman from a good middle-class family, had become a Parisian bohemian artist, and the quintessential American from the underculture of drug addiction and Hollywood-glamorized gangster crime, Wild West, and hoboism, totally unable to understand the point of view of the other until they both, quite drunk, slipped under the table at the same time and had to be taken home by taxi. They only met twice, and I was present on both occasions. The second was in Berlin in the early 80s, again almost certainly after the Frankfurt Book Fair, which was normally in October, sometimes a little earlier. Beckett was staying at the Académie des Künstes, a subsidized art center with lecture halls and stages where artists were allowed to stay in some comfort. Beckett was rehearsing one of his plays, working with German actors he already knew well. He was always very preoccupied on such occasions. His eyes were bad, and he had trouble reading the text in the dim rehearsal lights of a theater, and he would go to the trouble of memorizing the lines to be able to recite them to actors. And this was the German translation he was memorizing. He had a drink with a German writer and myself, a quick dinner with me, and went to his room to prepare for the next day. Immediately afterwards, I ran into Allen Ginsberg, Susan Sontag, and Fred Jordan, an American editor, and agreed to have lunch with them the next day. At the end of the meal, knowing Beckett was in town, they asked me to arrange a meeting. When I rang him, it was Sunday afternoon, Beckett agreed to see everyone for a short time only, and politely welcomed us in the Académie des Künstes flat. But the three Americans brought a bottle of whiskey and wanted a long session with Beckett, who was quite obviously anxious to get back to preparing for the next day's rehearsal, and politely asked us after half an hour to leave. Burroughs afterwards complained, above all to his biographers, what a rude man Beckett was for not giving them all the time they wanted to chat and gossip. During the 60s, and to a lesser extent during the 70s, Beckett would often stay with me in my London flat, then on Wimpole Street. He would stay reading or working in his room most of the morning, emerge for meals or occasionally to go out in the evening, and sometimes have others in to talk about his work, such as his theatrical agent, actors he knew, or friends. He frequently used the piano, seldom looking at music. He was very fond of my black Labrador Schooner, would go for walks with us both, and sometimes, as he put it, have the dog take him for a walk. On occasion we would walk as far as Hyde Park, where he would look for places he remembered, such as the cockpit, which plays a part in Murphy. The cockpit is a sort of hollow in the ground where you can be quite invisible, not very far from the Bayswater Road. Once on a Sunday, we went to listen to the orator at Hyde Park Corner. I thought he might be interested in hearing some of the Irish speakers, using their right of free speech to run down British government policy, and such like. But no. I suddenly saw him looking intently at a little huddled man, his body hunchbacked and twisted, his face like a Quasimodo, his head tilted, with staring rapturously up at one of the speakers. "What is it, Sam?" I asked. "Look at that," he answered. "What a beautiful sight." It was indeed like one of his own stage pictures, a crumpled and misshapen piece of humanity carried out of itself. All his old love of sport never left him, and he would settle himself in front of the television set for Wimbledon or cricket, or sometimes for other sports. When we went out, the dog usually came too. In those days, any restaurant still allowed dogs, provided they were well-behaved and made themselves invisible. Schooner, like all Labradors, was greedy, and Sam was a small eater. His hand was constantly slipping under the table to feed her. No wonder she loved him. Sam's visits to London were mostly to supervise productions of his plays. One such occasion was a premiere of Endgame. There had been some difficulty in finding a theatre in Paris, and Sam lost no time in making an English version. A few enthusiasts financed the English production, which was given in Paris at the Studio des Champs-Élysées, then an experimental theatre in the smart district of the city. They were led by Victor Herbert, an American, who had made much money as a super salesman for Bernie Kornfeld's Investors Overseas Services, one of those flash-in-the-pan enterprises that attract many investors, grow quickly to great heights, and then collapse through mismanagement. Philip Stebb, previously mentioned, was also one of the investors. Patrick McGee and Jack McGowan were cast in the major parts, and a young director was found to produce it. Sam came to London for the rehearsals, which were over a pub, and I went with him to some of them. Soon the actors were only listening to Sam and not the young director. It then opened in Paris with a considerable success, and the same theatre then agreed to mount the original French version, while Georges Devine at London's Royal Court Theatre revived it in English, a production that, with minor changes, later entered the repertory of the Royal Shakespeare Company. This was one of the many productions that brought Sam to London, where he usually stayed with me, and although he never received the credits for directing his own plays, he usually achieved the result he wanted. There was, on occasion, some conflict, not so much with the titular director, as with an actor who had his own ideas and was reluctant to tone down his usual delivery. Most of the time, Sam was the real director, knowing just what he wanted, and bringing a precision to the plays that was more like music than drama, and lifted them well above the usual commercial standard. I sat through many of the rehearsals and witnessed how, although often resistant at first, actors gradually bonded with Sam and learned to trust him absolutely. He stayed with me during the rehearsal of the 1964 Godot at the Royal Court, coming back every evening in a gloomy mood. He did not like Vladimir with Nicol Williamson. Nick had previously played a London barrister in a John Osborne play, and he still sounded like a London barrister, quite unsuitable for a tramp on a lonely country road, not knowing where the next meal is coming from. But one evening, his face was wreathed in smiles, and he told me why. When Sam asked Nicol if he was talking with his natural voice and where he had come from, he was told that the actor was a Scot from Dundee. "But that can't be your natural accent," exclaimed Sam. "No, I used to have a Scottish accent," he was told. "Why can't you use that?" suggested Beckett. And when Williamson did, the effect on the play was dramatic and credible. 2 days later, Sam was still smiling. "A touch of genius there," he said to me. Through Sam, and by going to rehearsals quite often, I got to know Nick quite well. The production was directed by Anthony Page, but the actors spent more time listening to Sam's line readings, and when the play opened to a new generation of London theatre-goers, it was very successful and usually sold out. Williamson, whose personality was as flamboyant as any actor I had met, revelled in the part. When he came to Vladimir's great speech at the end, his "I can't go on!" was a scream of agony that echoed through the theatre like a trumpet, followed, seconds later, by a very quiet, "What have I said?" I went several times, noticed how many of the audience were in their early 20s, and remember one young girl at the exit saying to her boyfriend in tones of awe, "But it's obscene! But really obscene!" Sometime after that, I was invited to give an evening of readings of Beckett's work at Stratford-on-Avon in the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre on a Sunday night, which turned out to be in their smaller studio space. I asked Nicol Williamson if he would like to take part, and he agreed if he could go over the text with Beckett himself, who at this point he revered. The other actor who agreed to read was Pat McGee, who, together with Jack McGowan, actors who were now very conversant with Beckett's work, I saw frequently. Williamson had now gone back into a revival of Inadmissible Evidence, the Osborne play where he was once again a London barrister. We had arranged to go to Paris together early one Sunday morning to work with Sam. We arranged to meet at a restaurant a few doors away from the Garrick Theatre, where he had a Saturday afternoon matinee. Over lunch we discussed the reading, while Nick enthused over Sam's genius and our trip the next day. 2 o'clock arrived, and looking at my watch, I suggested that he go to get ready. "I don't feel like it," he said, and going to the telephone, arranged for his understudy to take the matinee instead. Lunch went on until 4 o'clock, afterwards Nick insisted on coming home with me, and then telephoned his understudy to go on again that evening, a Saturday night that would have a full house, expecting to see the star actor in the part. He stayed with me for dinner, where I had other guests, and insisted on calling his dresser to join us. He left with him after 11 o'clock for a nightclub, saying he would be ready for me to pick him up at 6:30 the next morning. He was not ready, of course, and we only just made the flight with our taxi. Now on wake-up pills, Nick was quite outrageous on the plane, striding up and down the aisle, playing a part, and enormously embarrassing me as he brought me into his act. In Paris, we hired a car, picked up some food and wine, and drove to Issy, an hour or so away, where Sam was waiting for us. During the long morning, Sam read out the texts I had chosen, making some changes, while Nick repeated them. It was a warm summer day, and I fell asleep on the grass. Then we had lunch, but what we had brought was quite unnecessary. Sam had food and wine enough. It was all ready, and he gave us a little lesson on the French cheeses he had placed on the cheese board. Then the rehearsal went on. Afterwards, Sam announced that he had arranged for us to spend the night with the Idens, and we were going there for dinner. We drove in two cars, Nick and Sam's, with me following. I could see Nick gesticulating for Sam to stop for a drink every time they passed the village bistro, but Sam drove doggedly on until we reached the Iden house at La Fête-Sujard. It was a large, pleasant house with a big garden full of shady trees. We were given a tour of the studio and Henri Iden's canvases. He explained to us that he liked the flat look of the Marne countryside and now painted only landscapes. Then we had drinks while Fowl, the big old English sheepdog that had been adopted in the Falstaff, jumped all over Sam in delight while he fondled her. Then another drink in the garden. Through all this, Nick kept up a constant vaudeville act, quoting Shakespeare and other speeches, playing different personalities, crooning popular songs, hogging all the attention. Henri was obviously tired and bored with the non-stop entertainment, and Sam did not know how to stop it.
"Can you never be serious, Nick?" came out, with some irritation. But Nick couldn't.
The flow went on through dinner, the actor going from the table to the piano, imitating the voices of Frank Sinatra and Perry Como. Very well, of course, but it was not the occasion for it. As soon as we had finished dinner, Sam drove off to his little de chevaux, and Audie immediately went to bed. Left with an audience of two, Nichols slowed down, had another drink, then went to his room. I stayed on a little longer to talk to Josette, who had quite a lot to say about her life, centred in many ways on Sam, still vital and active, while Henri was now very old and depressed. The next morning we had breakfast and left, but Nichol did not want to return to London. He wanted to be left at any small nearby hotel.
"Just to be near him," he said.
He did not have one franc of French money, and had a performance that night in London. With considerable difficulty, I drove him into Paris, where I had a parcel to pick up, and although I was only 3 minutes out of the car, Nick had disappeared when I got back. It took me more than an hour to find him in a bar, then get to the airport, but I did deliver him at his flat on Cadogan Street at 4 o'clock, and with relief I went back to my office, where I soon had a telephone call from his worried agent, saying he was lost again. He was not seen for the whole week, missed every performance, and when Pat McGee turned up at my flat on Saturday morning to rehearse for the next day, I told him what had happened, that we would have to do the Stratford evening without Nick. Just then the doorbell rang, and Nick walked in. He refused any explanation.
"We have a performance tomorrow night," he said. "Let's get on with it,"
and he began to read his prepared texts. Pat looked at me in amazement.
"That's a perfect Dublin accent," he exclaimed.
Nick was imitating Sam exactly. I wanted us to drive together to Stratford-on-Avon, but Nick refused, saying he was going with friends. As 8 o'clock approached, Pat and I were sitting on the stage with no sign of Williamson. At 2 minutes to the hour, he walked in, and the performance began, going very well with a full house. At the end, Nick strode to the front and gave his familiar rendition of Vladimir's speech, "Trumpet, call, scream, and all." Pat turned to me. "Never, but never," he said, "will I ever appear on a stage with that man again." I promoted many readings of Beckett's works to help sell the novels and the poetry, and Sam was always willing to direct the actors in the way he wanted the lines to come over, if he could. When I published the novel How It Is, a difficult one, even for Beckett fans, I took the Criterion Theatre on a Sunday afternoon, had a panel chaired by Martin Essen to discuss the work in general, and that one in particular, interwoven with readings from How It Is and other works by Pat McGee and Jack McGowan. That was in 1964, and Sam came over to work with the actors at lunch with the panel, but he would not attend the performance. At it, I took a recording of McGee reading a passage that Beckett had selected for him, a very vivid one, and sent a small disc of it to every reviewer with the book. That disc is now priceless. I attended many rehearsals, both in London and Paris, and was present when Sam was rehearsing play and not I with Billy Whitelaw, saw the strong bond between them grow, and witnessed Kenneth Tyner breaking in on a rehearsal of the former at the Old Vic to tell Sam that Sir Larry does not approve of this way of doing things. George Devine, a rather passive figure during the rehearsal, quietly told him that Olivier was not the author, and the author knew best. Although by the 60s Samuel Beckett would no longer sit through any of his own plays with an audience present, he would frequently go with me to others, and we saw many of the Royal Shakespeare productions during the golden period at the Old Vic, and among others Max Frisch's Andorra at the Old Vic, where on this occasion it was Frisch who stayed away and met us for supper afterwards. There was one memorable Sunday afternoon when four of us, Beckett, Frisch, the cartoonist Vicky Weiss, and I, played simultaneous games of chess, with fascinating relaxed conversation, each playing the other three in turn. Not long after that, Harold Wilson's Labour Party came to power, to the great delight of Vicky. But when, as he saw it, the government failed to come up to its promise, he killed himself in a deep depression. Little in life is as sad and depressing as the deaths of old friends. Since before the war, Sam had developed a cavalier attitude to danger, seldom going out of his way to avoid it, and he had once described his wartime activities in the Resistance and the Mekkie as Boy Scout stuff, never going into details of actions that earned him the Croix de Guerre from de Gaulle. When friends died, Sam would keep his grief to himself and carry on normally. Con Leventhal, one of his oldest friends, developed cancer, thought he was cured, and when it returned, met his end in terror. Although Sam must have been greatly affected, he never showed it. His most trusted American director, Alan Schneider, was killed in London by a motorcycle, jumping the lights too quickly. He had been rehearsing a play in London, and was on his way back to the theatre after posting a letter to Sam, who I saw in Paris the following week. "I hope it was not the only letter he was posting," Sam said resignedly. But of course it was. His attitude to his own death smacked of indifference. "No matter where, no matter when," he says in a late poem. Although accident-prone, some special providence always seemed to be protecting him from the worst. His wartime survival seemed miraculous, and his post-war growth in the cheek, although it gave him much discomfort, was not malignant, and was removed. A serious fall into a garage pit cracked all his ribs and made him feel like a fool, but he got over it. He was knifed by a clochard before the war, but the knife missed every vital part. Sam was a careless driver, and I once had a hair-raising drive with him from Paris to London that I was certain would end in a serious accident. But in spite of bad eyesight and carelessness about other cars and the rules of the road, there was no mishap. I've talked about going to the theatre with Sam. This sometimes led to my publishing other playwrights. He also wrote me about plays he had liked, such as Marguerite Duras's The Square, which led to her joining my list. I also went on many occasions to the opera with him. He knew a great deal about opera, and in many ways his plays are constructed rather like operas, with memorable speeches that are really arias. One could say the same about Shakespeare. As with Verdi, for instance, there are set passages that can be thought of as duets or ensembles, and character parts where the voice itself suggests the goodness or badness of what is going on inside the mind of the character. Some of the plays have been set to music, but Beckett resisted permission for the full-length major ones, and for good reason. The music is already there. This is true of the poems as well. Many composers have tried to set them, but there is so much of the essence of music in the cadences that every attempt to add another dimension seems superfluous and wrong. On one occasion I took Sam to Glyndebourne, a place where much of the audience goes more for the glamour and party atmosphere than for the music. At the last moment I remembered that one was expected to wear dinner jackets.
and Sam, staying with me in London, had nothing like that, nor had he in Paris. I suggested hiring a suit at Mosbros, but Sam would not hear of it, and said he preferred not to go. Faced with the dilemma, I telephoned a friend, Michael Jelliot, then on the Glyndebourne staff, and asked his advice, saying that Sam only had a sports jacket, and I myself could hardly dress differently. "Don't worry," Michael told me. "Come as you are. It'll be all right." When we arrived, three men were waiting for us at the door in sports jackets. There were John Pritchard, that night's conductor, Gunter Rennert, resident producer and artistic director of Glyndebourne, and Jelliot. They took us into the tea room, made us feel at home, chatted for half an hour, then excused themselves to get on with their duties. Some have said that Beckett did not care for opera, but I know from experience that not only did he enjoy it, but he knew a great deal about it. This is true even of Wagner, whose themes and music may have been very different from his own outlook, but it was well within his field of knowledge. Wagnerian references make the occasional appearance in some of his writing. On this occasion, it was a rather lightweight Rossini opera, not even one of the deeper masterpieces of the repertoire, La Pietra del Paragone. Remembering Sam Beckett for someone whose relationship was always more personal than professional, in the sense that he needed no editor, because his work was meticulously revised and corrected, and always beautifully typed, means to me to recall incidents and anecdotes in the main. Long nights in cafes in the early days, quiet dinners and sometimes lunches in later ones, many walks, and sometimes meetings with others. His one-liners are, of course, famous and often repeated. He and Harold Hobson had developed a close friendship, not just because Hobson went to great pains to understand his work, much of which, because of Hobson's Christian Science face, would always be emotionally close to him, but largely because Sam always had great empathy to anyone seriously handicapped or disadvantaged, especially if they had the intelligence and the courage to deal with it in a positive way, as Hobson did. It was at the Lord's Cricket Ground that Hobson remarked that on such a beautiful day one was glad to be alive, and Beckett responded, "I wouldn't go as far as that." Once in Paris, walking in the street, I mentioned that it was a very fine morning, which it was, and after a glance at the sky, he answered, "So far." Understatements, on my part, were often followed by, to put it mildly. It was Sam's tendency to like people who were open and unpretentious, and he was only uncomfortable with those who simply wanted to take advantage of him or to impress him with their self-importance. But even there he was unjudgmental. Academics were always difficult to cope with, but he gave them a certain limited time, usually half an hour, and was as helpful as he could be within his own limits. Much thought, some recycled from other sources of literature, theology or philosophy, is always hidden in his work, and he was never very happy when it was discovered. Some of my own spottings did not please him, and when he felt he could not deny a reference, he would say he had forgotten. Of course, although the mind remained as creative and sharp as ever during his last years, when he retired to a nursing home, to live alone in a simple room with a few books and even fewer comforts, the memory did decline, and he had difficulty in finding some words, and sometimes remembering the names of even old friends. He knew exactly who they were, but the name suddenly vanished. His very final work, which could be viewed as a poem or a piece of prose, is about just that, the loss of a word. While still at the Boulevard Saint-Jacques, he would meet those he had agreed to see outside his flat. It was too difficult to ask someone to leave when he was tired or wanted to get on with something else, so he would make his appointments, usually for half an hour, either at a bar in Montparnasse or increasingly at the PLM Hotel immediately opposite his flat, walking in precisely on time and leaving exactly when he had resolved to do so. Once he had moved into Le Chertin, the nursing home, this was no longer possible. He was vulnerable to anyone who knew he was there, who could simply walk in on him at any time. It was there that I would go to see him during his last 3 years, always by appointment, and asking him to tell me when to leave. Every visitor brought him whiskey, but after he had asked me how to spell a word, a sign of the failing memory, I realized that he had no dictionary, and went to get him a two-language one, thereafter always bringing books. On one occasion I brought a mutual friend, but left her in the waiting room. When Sam asked after her, I mentioned that she was waiting for me outside. He immediately asked to see her, and we all had a glass of whiskey. But Sheila Colbin, who was with me, had to use his tooth mug, tasting of toothpaste. It was much earlier than this that Sheila and I had dinner with Sam one night at La Palette. I had a delicate financial matter to settle with him, and asked Sheila to arrive late. The matter resolved, we had a pleasant dinner, and at the end I asked him if there was anything new in the pipeline. Reaching into his briefcase, he brought out a slim manuscript in a plastic folder and handed it over to me. "You probably won't like it," he said, "and you don't have to publish it." I put it away, and we finished dinner and separated. It was still early, and Sheila and I went to the Falstaff, where we met Josette Iden, a widow now, and Marion Lee, who had lived with Con Leventhal during his last years. We had a drink together, the two ladies left, and a little later so did we. Back at the hotel I realized that I no longer had the plastic folder. I telephoned the Falstaff and said they had found nothing. Rushing back to the still open bar, I went to the back and looked through the rubbish bins. There, finally, I found the folder, cleaned it off, and took it back to the hotel, where at 4 in the morning I first read Westward Ho, his second last substantial prose work. It was only followed by Stirring Still, written for Barney Rossett, who, having sold his publishing firm and been dismissed by the new owners, then asked Sam for something to publish to keep the connection. Sam's favourite restaurants and meeting places would change from time to time, either because the proprietor who knew him had sold to a less welcoming management, or because the congenial atmosphere became different. La Closerie des Lilas was one of the haunts of the pre-war surrealists, but then somewhere in the late 70s it became a fashionable tourist restaurant, and the one-time regulars, mostly all artists, disappeared. On one occasion, John Drummond, then director of the Edinburgh Festival, and Sheila Colbin, his deputy at the time, were in Paris to see him to discuss a big series of Beckett programs the following year. I had, of course, been lobbying for this for a long time, and at last it was going to happen. We all met at the Coupole Bar, and then decided, as Sam was in good form, to have dinner together. We walked down the Boulevard Montparnasse towards the Closerie, where we found a table. But the buzz of business people and tourists, who had found the place because it was in the fashionable guides, was not the kind of relaxed atmosphere that Sam liked, and he began to look increasingly distressed as he looked around at unfamiliar faces and a very different world from his. Drummond recognized the signals instantly, folded his napkin, called the head waiter, said that one of us was not feeling well and we had to leave. A few minutes later, we passed a very simple Chinese restaurant, not very full, and went in. "That's better," smiled Sam as we unfolded our napkins. Drummond had left the festival by the next year, but his successor continued the Beckett programming, and half a dozen Beckett plays, several other events, and a conference made it a real success. There was no way, of course, that Beckett could be persuaded to come, but through Snyder's posthumous productions and actors like David Wadlow, who had worked directly with Sam, his influence was very present, and some of the productions went on to London and to other countries. I had planned, through an abortive attempt to start a new theatre in Soho, my own Beckett festivals in the past, and Sam had always supported me in these, especially when I was also combating censorship, about which he had always felt strongly. At one point when I had been prosecuted for obscenity in an American novel called Last Exit to Brooklyn, a long battle that I only won after 2 years in the courts, Sam held back a play for me for a long time. It was Come and Go, which had its British premiere at the Royal Festival Hall and a fundraising theatrical and musical evening to support civil liberties and our anti-censorship campaign. It was not possible to know Samuel Beckett without being aware of his concern for the suffering of the world and his extreme kindness to anyone he was able to help, encourage, or relieve from some burden. There were students who went to interview him for their student magazines, who, after admitting that they were having difficulty in paying for their studies, found later that he had paid for them secretly and anonymously. He once encountered two Irish labourers in Paris on holiday, not knowing where to go or what to do, to whom he gave the best evening of their lives at a good restaurant and then at a nightclub. He once handed all the money in his pocket to an Irish tourist, who had been mugged and had not eaten since the previous day, whom he encountered when waiting for his passport to be renewed at the consulate. Then Sam was unable to pay for the passport, and had to walk home, not even having enough to pay his bus fare. Such tales abound, and all the considerable amounts of money that came with the Nobel Prize went to help others, often struggling writers and artists. He lived simply, and a word that he used frequently in his last years was discard, as he gave away possessions, manuscripts, and favorite old books. He abandoned the faith he grew up in, but remained God-haunted, intensely spiritual, but with a mystical quality that held no hope. But he accepted what could not be avoided, like the Stoics of antiquity. Knowing him was an extraordinary privilege. In spite of the bleakness of his view of the human condition, he has paradoxically convinced many that personal contentment can only come from unselfishness and helping others, that such virtue is not only its own reward, but the key to living comfortably with oneself.